Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Regan, and I'm a licensed addiction counselor and certified grief counselor for Heartview Foundation in Bismarck, and welcome to a program that we call Recovery Chronicles. On this program, we celebrate recovery, we talk about recovery, and we have a real special guest today. Her name is Dr. Melissa Henke. We call her Missy. She happens to be the medical director at Heartview Foundation, so she knows a lot about medicine and a lot about addiction. I have a list of questions. I'm not even sure we'll get to them all. But Missy, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for agreeing to come. And tell us, I'm embarrassed. I don't even know where you're from. I don't know much about your family background. Why don't you tell us?
Sure. So I grew up in Hazen. I have one older brother. My dad was a coal miner, and he worked in Center for years, and my mom worked at the hardware store. So no one in my family comes from the field of medicine. I was kind of an outlier. In fact, my brother was the first grandchild on my mom's side of the family and on my dad's side of the family to actually graduate from college. So we come from hardworking, blue-collar kind of people.
Hardworking stock, huh?
Yeah.
And I know you're married. I happen to know your husband's a physician. I know you have a few kids, if you would talk about that.
Yeah, my girls are in the 7th and 8th grade, and my son is in the 2nd grade, and my husband is an emergency room physician here in Bismarck, so we're busy.
Yeah. So what attracted you to the medical field, and particularly addiction?
So growing up, I've always loved science. My grandfather got sick when I was in late elementary school. He had mesothelioma from exposure to asbestos. And I remember when he was in the hospital, what an impact it had on my mom and her siblings and my grandmother when the physician came in the room. He could always sort of answer their questions and make them feel better. And I thought that was pretty cool. And it also, I got to use my love of science. So, addiction was actually not a field that I was interested in at all. So when I finished my residency, I was dual boarded in internal medicine and psychiatry. So moved back to Bismarck, and I actually ran into Kurt, who's the executive director.
Kurt Snyder, yes.
Yeah, so I ran into him at Target one night. I was shopping with my kids, and while I was in residency, he had married a good friend of mine. And the week that I ran into him, the medical director had just turned in his resignation, and so Kurt's wife actually said, "Kurt, Missy should be your medical director." I said, "Oh no, I don't want to work in addiction. I don't like addiction. It doesn't work for me." And he said, "Well, just come in and we'll talk about it." And so came in and heard a little bit about Heartview. And initially, I just came over for 1 hour a week and signed off on policies and procedures. And then eventually, we started using medication-assisted treatment, and that was in December of 2009.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
So you are, I know you're double boarded, but now I just found out you're also triple boarded.
Right.
What we mean by that, you're boarded in, you passed the boards in psychiatry, you are boarded in internal medicine.
Yep.
And you are also boarded in?
In addiction medicine. So because of the addiction epidemic that we have in this country, they changed the rules a little bit as far as it used to be you had to do a fellowship in order to take the boards, but they wanted more people to be board eligible because of how much addiction we're seeing. And so they changed the rules that if you spend enough hours working in addiction, you can sit for the boards without doing a fellowship. So since what I do is addiction medicine, I took the boards about a year ago. So, yeah.
Well, how long have you been at Heartview?
We've been doing medication-assisted treatment since December of 2009. I think I started there in the spring of 2009.
Yeah. You seem to like it. I mean, I think the audience knows, I work at Heartview part-time as an addiction counselor and do some grief counseling. You seem to like it, and certainly the patients seem to like you.
It is that working with people to help them find recovery is absolutely the most gratifying, rewarding thing I've ever done. So even though initially I did not want to work with addiction, now there is nothing I would rather do with my career. I left my job at Sanford about 7 years ago. This is what I do full time. I love educating people on addiction and recovery, and it is my passion.
Oh yeah, I mean you can tell. I mean, and that's a compliment. So you're one of those very happy individuals who has truly found their calling?
This has been a wonderful opportunity for me. I get to work with law enforcement. I get to work with government officials. I've been able to testify at the Capitol. I sit on the Governor's Council for Recovery Reinvented, and I feel like working in this field has opened my eyes, and hopefully I can help open other people's eyes.
Certainly every time an addiction is talked about in this community or perhaps even in the state, you are at the table, you know, so that's...
It has been a really fun road for me.
I was going to venture into trying to define addiction. I mean, as a counselor, I've seen the definition change over the years, and maybe we're fine-tuning it, but give us your best layperson's definition of addiction.
Right. So actually, ASAM, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, just came out with a new definition within the last 2-3 months, I think, and I do not know it off the top of my head, but basically what they wanted, when they redefined it, they wanted to make sure people understood that this is a chronic disease of the brain, that it is treatable, that it is not any worse than any other chronic medical problem we deal with, but that there's medications for it, that relapses are part of that definition, and that we need really a multi-team approach to most effectively manage it. But yeah, I always, when I talk to people, I say, it's not any worse than diabetes or heart disease or anything else as far as relapse rates, success rates, but we also need all hands on deck, that full court press where we use physicians, psychologists, social workers, licensed addiction counselors. We need everyone on board if we're going to have good success rates.
And of course, when we diagnose addiction, there's certain things that we look for. Could you name a couple of those items?
When I think about diagnosing an opioid use disorder, an alcohol use disorder, the criteria are the same. You just change the drug that you're talking about. But there's biologic criteria, there's psychologic criteria, and there's social criteria. And so it's using despite having harmful consequences. It's a lack of control. It's compulsive behaviors. It's not doing the things you need to do. But I think that at the core, it's basically having a loss of control and having negative consequences.
Yeah, I mean, and one of my quick definitions, if I'm talking to the public, is continuing to do things against your better judgment,
right,
and ignoring the negative consequences.
Right, despite the harmful consequences. There's, you know, and when I talk to people who don't have an understanding of addiction, they're like, well, it just doesn't make sense to me. Well, it's not rational. I mean, the behaviors aren't rational, but it's no more irrational than having diabetes and not counting your carbs or not taking your insulin. It's no more irrational than that. So it's a disease of the brain.
So I was so excited about having you on the program because of this current opioid crisis and opioid epidemic. And I thought, well, and I wanted to ask some pertinent questions or some layman's questions, most of all, to help people understand what's going on across the country, and is North Dakota affected? But let's start with what are the opioids? That's kind of a fancy word.
Sure, it is a fancy word. So originally, opiates came from the poppy plant. So it was heroin and morphine, and those from those we created this class of medications that their primary purpose is for pain management. However, heroin obviously is widely abused now, and it no longer has medicinal purposes, but it was created as an actual medication more than 100 years ago. So offshoots of that, because of course we like to create things in laboratories. We don't just like to leave it up to nature. So we now have carfentanil, fentanyl, and OxyContin, and all of those that are created in laboratories to become, they are certainly more potent. They also are more widely abused. But when OxyContin came out, the pharmaceutical company said, oh, you can't crush this, you can't shoot this. But of course,
when you say shoot, you mean
use IV. You can't use it IV, but obviously that is not true.
Right, and when you say you can't crush it, you're also referring to crushing it into a powder and snorting it,
because snorting it or using it IV. But yeah, when the medicines were created, they have different molecular structures so that it's difficult to do that. But I remember talking to a pharmaceutical rep when I was in residency, and I said, yeah, your scientists can't do that in a lab using all the safest machines, but my patients in a garage don't really care if it's sterile or safe. So it absolutely can be injected and snorted and smoked. Yeah.
And what are you and what are we seeing in North Dakota? It's has the epidemic
unfortunately
affected us.
Yeah, unfortunately. We have heroin on our streets. We have fentanyl and carfentanil and all of those things. And the problem is you can't trust your drug dealer. So you might think that you're getting heroin, but what you're really getting is heroin laced with fentanyl and Xanax. And so now there's also an entire industry where they press pills to look like one thing, but it is another. So it might look like an OxyContin 15 milligram, but what you're actually getting is carfentanil and Xanax, and that's a very lethal combination.
Well, how did use of painkillers become an epidemic?
We were duped. we really were duped. We were led to believe that, first off, that pain is something that should be managed, that we shouldn't have to experience pain.
Ever.
Yeah. And nowhere does it say in any rule book that we shouldn't have pain. So we made pain a vital sign, which means every time you go to the doctor or dentist, they ask you what your pain is. But then, unfortunately, it becomes regulated. So if I come in and I say, well, my pain is 10 out of 10, and the doctor doesn't treat my pain, then it becomes he's liable for, you know, not managing my pain. So
and he can get a poor rating.
He can get a poor rating, and, you know, he can get dinged when the governing bodies come and look at the institution. And so we started giving everyone a little bit of pain pills. Oh, you're hurting. Here's some hydrocodone. Here's some OxyContin, whatever. But so we flooded the streets with opiates. And we also created a specialty called pain management, where their whole purpose was to manage pain. And around that same time, Big Pharma came in and said, you know what? If people have pain, they will not experience a high when they take opiates and they won't abuse it. Those were just completely false statements. So what happened was people got addicted. We flooded the streets with opiates. Yeah. And now as providers, we've gotten smarter and we no longer, you know, give everyone pain pills. But unfortunately, they're already addicted. So they switched to heroin, which is even more dangerous.
Yeah. What's the process of becoming addicted to I mean, I've heard a lot of descriptions, but how do you describe it to, you know, to the patient or to the mom and dad or dad of the patient.
Right. So if you're taking a medicine as prescribed, if you're taking pain pills as prescribed, your body can still become dependent on those. Meaning if you don't have them, you'll become sick. Now that doesn't mean everyone who takes pain pills ends up being addicted, but it does mean that your body becomes reliant on it. So as soon as you start taking more than prescribed or taking it for other reasons than what it's prescribed for, opiates are not meant to be prescribed, you know, to help you sleep. They're not meant to be prescribed to help you clean your house. So when you start taking them as you see fit instead of how they were ordered, then we're on a slippery slope.
Right. And it's my understanding, I am a person in long-term recovery, but not from opioids, but I've heard the withdrawal described as the worst flu you ever had.
Right.
And you don't even want to go out and get more for the high. You just want to feel normal. I mean, you're absolutely sick and you're trying to function.
So the withdrawal that we experience from any drug is the opposite of the high that we get. Mm-hmm. So opiates slow everything down. So they slow down our bowels, our bladder, we get dry mouth, our heart rate slows down, our respiratory rate slows down, everything slows down. So what that means is if you don't have them, everything speeds up. So you have diarrhea, vomiting, anxiety, runny nose, watery eyes, restless legs, a backache, you can't sleep, you're anxious, all of these miserable flu symptoms. And the problem is what's different about opiate withdrawal and the flu is you know how to fix opiate withdrawal. You just have to take an opiate and it all goes away.
Whereas
with influenza, we don't have anything like that. So the analogy that I give lay people is if you've ever had influenza and someone said, okay, this little pill in my hand will fix it, but whatever you do, don't take it.
Right.
Yeah. Who amongst us wouldn't relieve those horrible feelings that we're having? So, and that's part of the compulsion that we have with addiction is if you know how to fix something, you start lying to yourself and say, well, I'll just do it one time and then I'll regroup and then I'll be better tomorrow. But that's not what happens. You just keep using.
Right. Now we have medications that treat individuals who are painkiller addicts. And I know that HeartView was pretty pioneering in using those medications in North Dakota. What are those medications and so what do they do?
There are three different medications that we can use to treat opioid use disorder. The one that you probably hear the most about is buprenorphine, which is the active component of Suboxone. What it does is it looks enough like an opiate that it tricks your brain into thinking you have opiates so you don't have cravings and you don't have withdrawal and you can function. But because it's a little bit different, you also don't get the euphoric high. So Suboxone you hear a lot about, but then methadone has actually been around longer. Methadone's been around since the late 60s, early 70s. And it stays in your system a very long time, so you can take it once a day. And again, because of how it binds, you're less likely to have that euphoric high, but you also don't have the cravings, don't have the withdrawal, so you can function. And then the third medication is naltrexone, which works completely differently. It blocks your receptors so that if you use, you don't get high. The downside with naltrexone is you have to be completely through that horrible withdrawal before we can utilize that. So if someone is hospitalized or incarcerated and through their withdrawal, then that might be an option. But primarily we use buprenorphine and methadone.
Yeah, we usually just call it bup.
We call it bup, yeah.
And methadone, we usually call methadone, I guess.
Right? But it's interesting because the whole process of using those medicines is called medication-assisted treatment. Mm-hmm. It's not medication-replacing treatment. It's not me just giving out scripts. It's me working with licensed addiction counselors, psychologists, social workers, nursing staff to give people that full court press and all the support that they need. Because you know, if you're trying to find recovery and no one's dealing with your trauma or your grief issues, it's much more difficult. So it really is medication assisting treatment.
Yeah, right. And I take it that most patients or most individuals who come to you looking for medication assisted treatment, their long-term plan is to get off of those medications eventually. Is that correct?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Some people have really struggled so much with their opioid use disorder over decades of time that when they get their life back in order using these medications and the rest of their recovery tools, sometimes they have no desire to come off of them at all. And I basically tell them, this is a chronic illness. It's meant to be treated chronically. So as long as you can comply with our program requirements, you can stay on this medication as long as you want to. I have people that have been with me for almost 10 years now.
Yeah. You know, you do hear sometimes in different circles that, and it's meant to be a criticism, but I'm not sure it's fact-based, but the people say, well, that medication-assisted therapy, that's just trading one drug for another, and they have a rather negative view of the whole thing. What's your comeback on that? Well, I hear that even as a counselor going to conferences for counselors.
Yes. And there is, we talk about the shame and stigma of addiction, but there's also a stigma against utilizing these meds. Oh, people on Suboxone aren't really clean. People that take methadone aren't really sober. Yeah. So my take on that is that recovery looks different for every person in recovery. So if you put 100 people in recovery in a room, they should have 100 different recoveries. Mm-hmm. Everyone's should be a little different. So how I know my patients are not replacing one drug for another is because I watch them live their life. They get jobs, they go to college, they pay their bills, they do all the things we do as normal people that they certainly did not do when they were using OxyContin and heroin or alcohol or whatever the case may be. So I know they're in recovery based on how they're living their life, regardless of the medications they're taking.
Sure. Once upon a time, their lives were a mess. They were living with the insanity
of addiction. If you're a heroin addict and you go and get OxyContin, you're not going to take that as prescribed. But because of how these medicines are created and how they work, they're less likely to be abused. Now, do people abuse medications? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. People abuse over-the-counter medications. Mm-hmm. But again, when you're living your life, taking care of your kids and getting off probation.
Being a good husband or good wife and holding a job and all of that.
So, and we do see, when we first started doing Suboxone 10 years ago at Heartview, we had counselors that came in and said, I don't want your patients in my group. I don't want them with my patients who are trying to find real recovery. Mm-hmm. Within 6 months, those same counselors were coming in saying, I want your patients in my group because they're phenomenal, and they actually are working programs, and they're doing everything I want them to do because they're motivated. Because if they don't do those things, they don't get to have this medication that literally is changing their life. So they're some of the most motivated people in recovery that you'll ever interact with.
Sure. I was going to mention it. Maybe I'd mentioned this to you in the past, but my hometown is Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I went to University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and I hit the college campus in 1968, and I'm almost positive that Milwaukee had a methadone clinic in 1970. I'd have to look it up, but you have to remember the times. We had the counterculture, you know, the so-called hippie culture, and the Woodstock era. We also had the veterans coming back from Vietnam.
I was going to say, a lot of people got addicted to heroin in Vietnam. Yeah. And so they were coming back and had to do something about that.
Absolutely. So. And so when I first came here and I did serve on the Heartview Board of Directors for a while before I became a counselor, but I was kind of surprised to find out that there was no methadone clinic, because I'm saying to myself, you know, what's the big deal? This Milwaukee had one in 1970, if not earlier. But I don't know if you can compare the two times, but do you think this is the worst time for addiction in this country? I mean, certainly in the urban centers, those late 60s, early 70s, they were tough. But
they were.
Do you think it's... Given the opioid epidemic right now, and you know, meth has never gone away, and alcohol's never gone away, are we seeing about the worst we've ever seen in America? Do you think?
From a numbers standpoint, absolutely. Mm. So in 2017, 70,000 people died in this country from drug overdoses. Now, almost 50,000 of those were opiates, but that still leaves 20,000 that died of other drugs, which is methamphetamine and cocaine, benzos. You know. All of those things. So we certainly, from my standpoint, we're seeing it as bad as it's ever been. And some of that is just because we have this technology, which makes it very easy to acquire drugs. You know, you don't have to go to your street corner to find a heroin dealer. You can just get on the internet and order it and have it FedEx to your house. From an access standpoint, if you live in rural Montana or rural North Dakota, it's much easier to get heroin and meth than it has ever been before. Mm-hmm. The other thing is all of our drugs are getting more potent. The heroin is more potent than it was. THC is more. You know, our marijuana is higher potencies than it's ever been. Methamphetamine is the same thing. Mm-hmm. So we're getting stronger drugs. I also think that as a society, we've become very lazy about taking care of ourselves. So one of my passions is wellness. Mm-hmm. You know, if I have to turn the TV on to decide what medication to talk to my doctor about, we have a real problem. You know, it's become, what's the next commercial? What drug do I need? Well, I would maintain that if you can't sleep well, maybe we should look at sleep hygiene, and we should look at how you're eating and what you're drinking
exercising
and all of those things. But we've become very susceptible to this idea that I don't like how I feel. There's probably a medicine I should take, instead of I don't like how I feel. What can I do to change that?
Exactly.
And so as we've become a pill-popping society, the pills have become very, very dangerous.
Well, and by far, America is the most pill-popping society
absolutely.
On the globe.
we're
millions and millions of pills.
Yes, we are 5% of the world's population. We consume 80% of the world's prescription pain pills. Mm-hmm. And we get to claim 27% of the world's opiate overdose deaths.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're not doing something right, obviously. And so, you know, in in the late 60s, early 70s, we had certainly an opiate epidemic, and then you had the cocaine epidemic in Florida in the early 80s, mm-hmm. And then it was pain pills, and now it's heroin.
Yeah, as I recall, again, I'm reflecting my own age here, but during the disco craze, you know, the disco slash Andy Warhol days, I think cocaine was way at the top of the list
as a club drug.
As a club drug, a leisure drug. Now there's kind of a new club drug associated with raves. You know what I'm...
Sure, Molly.
Yeah.
Ecstasy. Yeah.
The drug... tell us about the drug ecstasy. What is that?
Well, it's an interesting drug that, it changes people's sexual experiences, and it changes their visual experience. It doesn't fit nice and neat into like a category. It's kind of its own, but it's mm-hmm. in that camp of, you know, causes perceptual disturbances. And
I think it's part hallucinogenic.
Yeah, but it's also very stimulating.
Yeah, so it's kind of like half. In my days, we called drugs uppers and downers. And mm-hmm. and so I get the impression that ecstasy is sort of very half upper.
Right,
hallucinogen.
Right, yeah, it is. It has stimulating properties like methamphetamine or cocaine. And then the downers are more opiates,
benzos.
Alcohol, benzos, mm-hmm. absolutely. Yeah, and then, you know, there's... Again, as people use more, they tend to mix more. So I rarely see someone come in who just fails a drug screen for one substance. It's usually they're taking uppers and downers both because there's a different experience. Or if you're abusing opiates and all of a sudden you're in withdrawal, then stimulants make that withdrawal better. So we see so much crossover. And again, you can't trust your drug dealer, so you don't know what you're putting in your system. You think it's heroin.
Right.
Or you think it's marijuana. We've had a whole slew of patients lately that come in and say, yeah, I smoked weed, but they're failing for marijuana and meth. So things are laced. It's a scary time.
Has meth gone away in North Dakota? Is it going away?
Absolutely not. No, it is unfortunately not.
Maybe we have fewer labs, but the drugs are coming in.
It's different. Yeah. People aren't cooking it in the bathtub anymore. Mm-hmm. It's being delivered. They're ordering it. It's coming in different ways, and it is getting stronger. It's getting more potent. But absolutely, methamphetamine is not going away, and alcohol is, of course, not going away. The reason we talk so much about opiates is because they're so lethal acutely. You know, people will occasionally die of an alcohol overdose. But most of the time when people die of alcohol, it's from chronic alcohol use. Whereas with opiates, when people are dying, they were living and breathing 20 minutes ago and now they're dead. Yeah. So it becomes more of a crisis, and we're losing so many of our young people.
We are. Yeah. And that's one thing that I've seen. And I'm a late in life counselor, I mean, but and the number one thing that drew me into counseling, I had... The calling to become a counselor is the young people. Mm-hmm. I just knew, from raising children, and especially my younger daughter, and seeing how many friends she lost mm-hmm. To suicide, car crashes, overdoses.
Absolutely.
And I heard from other people working in social services telling me that among our young people, it was a crisis, and that really... that drew me into the profession, you might say, because...
Yeah, it is a scary time to be a parent.
And, yes, yes.
When I talk to people, I try to explain to them that we need to do a better job of talking to our children when they're in Head Start and not waiting till they're in high school. If we wait till they're in high school, we've already lost a percentage of them.
Yeah.
So we can have age-appropriate discussions with our preschoolers. You know, when my son was that age, we went to the public library and went into the bathroom, and there was a syringe on the floor. Mm-hmm. So we had the conversation of we don't touch those things, and if something looks like candy, don't put it in your mouth, and you only take medicines from mommy, daddy, grandma, and grandpa. And then as they get older, obviously those conversations change. So now that I have two middle schoolers, we're having very frank discussions. I'm not a sugarcoater. I feel like if we're not preparing our kids for what is out there, they're going to go to a party and think that they can just pop these pills and then, you know, chase it with a beer, and that could be the end of them. Mm-hmm. So I have very frank discussions with my children and their friends about how dangerous it is out there.
You know, true or false, you can get almost any drug you want today in junior high school.
Absolutely true.
You can get
IV heroin in our middle schools in Bismarck, which sickens me, considering I have two middle schoolers. But and I talk to people, they say, oh, that's not true. It is true. It is absolutely true. We have every drug you can imagine in our middle schools. That doesn't mean that they're sitting at the lunchroom table with it, but if you wanted to get it, there are ways to get it.
Yeah. And denial in when it comes to living in your community, denial about the availability of drugs and the extent of the problem. Denial is dangerous, isn't it?
Oh, it's very dangerous. Yeah. And I think that's why, you know, when I talk to realtors, they talk about how, you know, there was a time when we just had open houses. Now I give them a prep list of remove all your medicines and do all these things, because people go to open houses and then they go rummaging through your bathroom closet because it's appropriate
the medicine
in that
chest,
setting. Right. So it's interesting to me. And I was visiting with some athletic trainers from University of Mary about how they're on the front lines for young people being injured who may be getting opiates. And so they need to be aware so they can have those conversations. So I really think that as there is not a profession out there where it's not relevant. I've had calls from gas stations saying, can you come and talk to my staff about how to give Narcan, because we've had people overdose in our bathrooms.
Good for them.
It affects every single one of us.
Good for them for asking you. And I want to say right now that our guest is Dr. Melissa Henke, and she is the medical director of Heartview, and that's why we're talking about drugs and medicine, and she's a triple boarded in internal medicine, psychiatry, and addiction medicine. So you're quite a resource for us, and
thanks
a wonderful resource for our community. I take it you do a lot of public speaking. I've mentioned earlier you're on a lot of panels and such. So
I do some public speaking. I like to speak at the universities, University of Mary, United Tribes. I've spoke both of them. Bismarck State College, UND, NDSU. I like to work with young people at the start of their careers because there's so much stigma surrounding addiction and substance use disorders. And I really feel like until we change how people view it, we can't change the outcome. And so speaking to people early in their careers about how this happens, what it looks like, how do I identify it, how do I prevent it, that's how we're really going to change attitudes.
As a matter of fact, let's talk to parents right now. How do we identify, what are some signs we can look for in our junior high school age child or high school age child as far as whether or not they may be using drugs?
Right. And with young people, we have to look for changes in attitudes, changes in friend groups, changes in activities. If your kid has been a volleyball player and all of a sudden they have no interest in volleyball and all they want to do is, you know, hang out at the mall, that would be a red flag to me. So, or if they start, you know,
sleeping all day,
any sort of change, they're sleeping all day or they're up all night or they're any of those changes or attitude changes, if all of a sudden they're talking differently, acting differently, and
losing weight.
Right. When I was a kid, if you came home, if you were using, it would have been alcohol and marijuana, and both of those things smell bad, right? So my parents could smell me and see if I had done anything wrong. But it's not that simple anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's
right. Yeah.
It's not something that they advertise. But if you look at their skin, people who use methamphetamine lose weight and they pick their skin. And wearing long sleeves in the summertime in North Dakota is not normal unless you're trying to cover something up. So, you know, making sure we're looking at our kids and how are they acting? How are they looking? What are their grades doing? If you had a straight A student and all of a sudden weren't getting D's and C's, it could be a mental health problem or it could be a substance use problem. And the two are very much kissing cousins. If you're going down the road of substance use, you're going to have mental health problems. And if you have mental health problems, you're at higher risk for using drugs because, again, You don't like how you feel. And so you're going to look for something that makes you feel different.
Sure. And if you're, if you have anxiety or if you have depression, in the field, we call it self-medicating, don't we? They, they turn to drugs that, that take that anxiety away or supposedly, or they think it does.
And there, there's a period of time in, during early adolescence where our kids really don't care that much about what we have to say. They really care about what their friends have to say. And so if they're feeling depressed and anxious and we're not asking the right questions, their friends are going to be asking, and their friends may have solutions that we're not going to be okay with. So we got to make sure that we're asking, how's it going? What's going on? I noticed this about you. What's that about? Sometimes it's a different reason altogether, but sometimes it is, it is because they're starting to experiment.
And we know that when young people have, or when any of us might have anxiety and or depression, we can go to the doctor and sometimes get pills. Well, is there an inherent danger in these pills that our children may be prescribed?
Yeah, there's safer medicines, right? And then there's dangerous medicines. But you know, I'm a believer in healthy eating and exercise. And I know when I'm feeling anxious, I just have to pound it out on the pavement.
Right.
Go for a walk, go for a run, listen to music, you know. There are good coping skills, and we need to teach our children that. Now, there is also cases where someone may need to be appropriately prescribed a medication, but that should be an adjunct with counseling, especially during those developmental years. When we, our brains develop until we're 26 years old. So when we expose our developing brain to substances, even if they're a medicine, we can alter how our brain develops.
Yes.
So, yes, I'm having panic attacks at age 16, And maybe I need to use a medication, but I also need counseling, because otherwise I'm going to deal with this for the rest of my life. But if I can empower myself, learn some coping skills, change how I do things, then maybe I don't have to struggle with this for the rest of my life and ingest chemicals to make it better.
What are some of the medicines or prescriptions to sort of be aware of when it comes to treating attention deficit disorder or anxiety or depression? Are there, I think you just said, there are some safer ones. There are there are some not so safe ones, and there may be addiction potential. Should we name some? Or would,
you know, so there there are classes of medication.
Classes,
so,
you
know, when we treat ADHD, most of those are medicines are stimulants. So they're amphetamine derivatives or they're Ritalin derivatives. And there are some that long-acting meds are less likely to be abused, so that might be a better alternative. But there's also non-addictive choices that, you know, and I just encourage people to ask about that. ADHD is a tricky one because if you treat it appropriately, you actually lower someone's risk of developing a substance use disorder. So it's not something we want to ignore, but at the same time, we want to be diligent about it, and we want to make sure that we're, are you taking this as prescribed, or are you sharing it with your friends? Are you trading it for marijuana? Are you, what are you doing with it? There's nothing wrong with getting, if I'm prescribing a controlled substance to someone, there's nothing wrong with getting a drug screen to see, are you actually taking it? And what else are you taking with it? Because those those are real concerns.
And I did want to talk about, we've got about 20 minutes left, and we're talking to Dr. Melissa Henke. She's the medical director of Heartview Foundation. And I wanted to talk about marijuana because, you know, and there again, in my day, it was really unheard of in high school. I don't mind saying my age. I'm 69 years old. And, I mean, no, it really was unheard of. And maybe in Vietnam, it was, I mean, I know it was being used. But, I mean, the bad boys drank. They drank. You know, they showed up at the weekend dances with a bottle of booze hidden in their pocket or in the car, and they took free, you know, and that type of thing. But today, marijuana is just so pervasive, and now, you know, we have medical marijuana dispensaries, really in several North Dakota cities right now, and there's always a bill being proposed to legalize the recreation. How does this make you feel as a physician, as an addiction physician?
Well, and you can tell that marijuana is a hot button issue because if you pull up a map of the United States, it's legal in some states, it's medical in some states, it's totally outlawed in other states. Mm-hmm. And so we clearly don't know what we're doing with marijuana, and which makes it hard as a parent, again, to have those conversations of, you know, this is an abusable drug. And do I think that people can be social pot smokers? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Just like I think people can be social drinkers. Mm-hmm. But there is a subset of the population that can't do that.
Right, right.
Because they have the genetic predisposition, or they abuse other substances, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
It's not something to be taken lightly. There's more and more data showing that, again, if we expose our developing brain to this THC molecule, which again is getting much more potent. It's not the days of 11%. We're in the 20s now, almost in the 30s.
I think that Woodstock dope was about 5%.
Right. It was mostly ditchweed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not anymore.
Right, and so, very potent. You know, up to almost 100% potency.
Right. So as we expose developing brains to that chemical, we can change how the brains develop. And so we're seeing certainly increased risks of mental illness, specifically thought disturbances, psychotic disorders, anxiety. Hmm. So marijuana is one of those drugs that people will say, well, I use it for my anxiety. But it can turn on you. And pretty soon it makes you anxious. And so it's not a benign chemical. And again, there probably are medicinal uses for it, but because it's federally illegal, we don't have good studies on it because it's you can't study something that is a category one, right? It has no medicinal purposes according to the DEA.
Right.
So we can't study it. So we don't really know what's going to happen. And unfortunately, at this point, we'll probably just have to ride it out and see where we're at 20 years from now. Right.
Well, and I'm very honest on this program. I'm a person in recovery. And my drugs of choice were marijuana and alcohol. And when I say that, I mean in combination. I mean, that was my preferred high. And so given the potency of today's cannabis, I'm scared to death of it, which is a very good which is a very good thing because of the potency. And it also means, and I've said this to people, it also means I could never go to Denver again as a tourist because I have confirmed that when you go outdoors anywhere, or especially to an event, and since recreational marijuana is legal there, that you smell that all the time. Well, for me, that would be dangerous.
Right. The risk of someone developing a substance use disorder, more than half of that risk comes from their genetic makeup, which we obviously have no control over. So if you're a person of recovery, your kids need to be very, very careful about trying to be a social pot smoker because they're at high risk. And there's, again, conflicting information about, is marijuana a gateway drug? Is it not a gateway drug? And I think a lot of that comes down to your genetic makeup. You know, if you're not someone who's predisposed to that, maybe it wouldn't be a gateway drug.
Yeah.
But maybe it would be. So
given the individuals trying cannabis for the first time, let's say they're in Denver, but do we not know that a certain percentage of people who try it are going to become addicted to it?
I don't know that we know those percentages, but it's just like alcohol. I mean, Bill W. said the first time he took a drink, it's how he wanted to feel for the rest of his life, right? He'd waited his whole life to feel like that.
Right.
So, I mean, certainly there are going to be people who try it and then think, oh my gosh, it solves all my problems. Well, and we don't know. I can't even draw a blood test and say, oh yeah, you know, you're gonna end up addicted. We don't know. So it's a little bit of trial and error.
Sure.
And when I talk to my patients, because they always want to argue with me that it's a medicine and it does all these things for you, and I said, but what you don't realize is when they did those studies, they excluded people who have a history of substance use disorders because they knew that it would throw off their data.
Right.
Because if you abuse one substance, you're much more likely to abuse another.
Sure.
So when you're arguing with me that you should be able to take it for your anxiety because it helps, I would argue that you weren't included in the studies where they were trying to see if it had benefit because they knew you were at high risk of abusing it. Right, so we just don't have good data.
Yeah. I'm glad you touched upon what you touched upon just now. What we see as addiction counselors once in a while is individuals who are heroin addicts or opioid addicts or methamphetamine addicts. Even during treatment, they might go out and drink, and they may not consider that a slip or a relapse. You know, they come back the next day to treatment or to group therapy or what have you, and they say, "Well,
it's not my drug of choice.
I'm a heroin addict. So who cares if I go out and have a couple of beers?" So. What do you say to that?
What I tell people is, if you're a heroin addict, that is the drug that your body wants. So none of us get smarter by using alcohol. None of us make better choices by using alcohol. So if you drink, there's a good possibility that that will lower your inhibitions enough that you will then go out and seek the high that you want. And I see that routinely where they, I just thought I could have a couple drinks, but then I ended up using heroin.
Yeah.
Well, because your brain knew you were impaired, and so it took advantage of you. But and then the same thing happens with marijuana, and people will say, "Well, no one's dying of marijuana overdoses." Well, that's true. I mean, as far as it is not acutely lethal, but it obviously is still impairing, or people wouldn't be so hell-bent on getting it. You know, I mean, if nobody is trying to defend their use of Zoloft, right? But people will want to engage in really significant arguments over why they should be able to use THC. Well, it must do something. It's a very powerful chemical.
Exactly. I think what happened to me at times is I would take cannabis and I would smoke cannabis, and it sometimes made me anxious, nervous, paranoid. Well, what would take the edge off? Alcohol. So. You know, so it's really a vicious,
very much a vicious cycle,
circle there. I believe, and this is what I've heard, and that patients, individuals, before they become patients, they're presenting to us with greater acuity, if that's the right word, but they're sicker. Good. They have multiple problems. I mean, you just said earlier. They're using multiple drugs, but I think we're finding that they also have different other mental afflictions. I'm not sure that's the right word. But
and it's not just mental illness, it's physical illness. You know, I mean, well over half of my patients coming in seeking medication-assisted treatment have hepatitis C.
Right.
It has become increasingly prevalent. And again, depression and anxiety. But if you think about that, if you're using uppers, they're going to make you anxious. And if you're using downers, they're going to make you depressed. And if you're using them on and you've lost control of that ability to stop using, you're going to feel depressed. You're going to feel ashamed. And shame feeds that depression, and that depression feeds your drug use. And it becomes this ugly cycle of, everyone that comes through the doors of Heartview gets asked about depression, anxiety, insomnia, but also hepatitis C, head injuries. How many times have you overdosed? Because we know, and this is so, again, counterintuitive, if you've overdosed once, you're at much higher risk of doing it again. Again, there's nothing rational about that, because I think, okay, if I almost died once, maybe that would scare me straight, but that's not what happens.
Right, yeah. And explain the physiology of someone quitting heroin or even alcohol for maybe even years, and then they come back to it, they relapse, and go back to the same dose. I mean, and that is how some people die.
Absolutely. One of the primary risk factors for overdose is a period of recovery, a period of non-drug using. So, because what happens is tolerance is one of the medical or one of the biologic criteria of a substance use disorder. And what that means is it takes more of the substance to get the same effect. So again, most people listening to your program have probably had a drink of alcohol. And if you remember the first time you drank half a beer, you got a little buzzed and slurry, but the more often you did that, the more it took to feel that way. And that is tolerance.
Yes.
So what happens is if you take someone who's addicted to opiates and you put them in jail or you put them in treatment and they go through their withdrawal, but they then lose their tolerance. Mm-hmm. So what happens is if they come out and they're used to smoking a half gram of heroin, that will probably kill them. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, they have to go back to using less and ideally not using at all, but they're right. at much higher risk of dying by overdose.
Yeah. Yeah. And then going back to that, the concept of addiction as a progressive mm-hmm. disease, that fits, that certainly fits that, doesn't it?
It does.
To a certain extent.
Right. You lose your tolerance, but then once you go back to using it, you get pretty far down in a big hurry. You know, when you started using, it might have taken you 3-4 years to really have the wheels fall off and lose everything and not be able to hold down a job. But if you have sobriety and you go back to using, you'll get there a lot faster than 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be weeks to months and you'll be homeless again. And
so what is sort of meant by it, it's a progressive disease. If you relapse, pretty soon you'll be back right where you were, including at the same tolerance level, really quickly, a lot quicker than it would take someone who
right, and a
was
lot quicker
not,
than it took you the first time, right?
Exactly.
I mean, so that's and again, we talk about that biologic, psychologic, and social criteria, and they all you all get there in a big hurry with each relapse, and then every relapse after that, it's even faster. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, people will say, I just thought I could go out and use one time and there I was, you know, 2 weeks later I was homeless and lost my job. And
right. Sometimes we say you're off and running.
Yeah. No, I always just say you're off the rails. You're off the rails again.
You're off. Why is relapse? Why does it seem to be so common in addiction in the field we work in?
Well, I think partly because, a relapse in addiction is a very visual thing. You can see when someone has relapsed, whether it's because they lose weight, they pick their skin apart. I mean, it becomes very evident very quickly because their whole family notices, their medical providers notice. But if you look at relapse rates with chronic medical problems, addiction is right smack dab in the middle. It's very similar to diabetes, heart disease, and hypertension. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about managing a chronic medical problem, most of us can do that for a period of time and then we get lazy or something happens. You know, our child gets sick, our parent dies, something happens.
Yes.
And then we don't take care of our recovery like we need to.
Yes.
Just like we don't take care of our diabetes like we need to. And then we're more likely to relapse and stop doing the things that we're working.
Sure. You know, for example, not going to counseling, not going to support groups, not going to church, falling off the radar that way, not hanging around supportive people.
Right.
You know, all the things, not exercising, all the things we need to do.
It's one of the advantages of medication-assisted treatment because it keeps people engaged.
Sure.
And there have been people that I've been seeing every month for 10 years.
Yes.
So they come in the door and they don't just see me. They see my receptionist, my lab girl, my nurse. They see all of us and they stay engaged. And that monthly contact sort of keeps their toes to the fire and it keeps them engaged with us. And then sometimes I'll say to someone, well, we could go to every other month. And they go, we should just stick to monthly. I'm okay, then just keep coming. No. But that is one of the advantages of medication-assisted treatment. It keeps people coming back.
I can see that. We only have about 5 minutes left. I told you it would go fast.
Did go fast.
And so a couple of getting back to you personally, and our guest today is Dr. Melissa Hanke. We call her Missy at Heartview. She is the medical director. What's the most rewarding part about being the medical director of an addiction center, or treatment center?
It is absolutely my contact with patients. Mm. When I see someone who gets it and they change their life, it's not just their life that changes. It's their kids, their parents, their significant other, their employer. It's this great trickle-down effect where they start making good choices and all of a sudden their kids are making better choices and things really start to fall into place for them. And that is the coolest thing for me to see people come in and they tell me, I got off probation or my PO said he only needs to see me every other month or my kid made the honor roll. And we get to celebrate all those things that as a person who's not in recovery, I didn't even realize how significant those events are. But being able to rent an apartment and pay your rent and being able to get a job, though you have three felonies, those are huge milestones for people. And it's so fun to celebrate those little things that that people take for granted that I don't even think about. Get in an apartment. I don't even remember if my parents had to co-sign the first time I got an apartment.
Right.
But for the people that I work with, those are huge milestones.
And, you know, I should have ended with the upside, but what's the challenging part of working in the field?
The challenging part is that these drugs are very potent and they definitely do what they're supposed to do. So so when I have patients who have pain, whether it's from a grief or a trauma or something like that, these opiates are very potent and they will make that pain go away in a way that I can't do for them. You know, recovery takes work and it's a process and it takes time. And so the hardest part is when people decide that they don't, they can't do the work right now, you know, that it's, it's just too much or the pain is too significant. The trauma is too overwhelming. So when we lose people, that is, really devastating to me. And I understand that that's part of this, whether, even if I was treating diabetes, I would lose people to that illness.
Diabetes, cancer.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But, it's so hard because these people are usually younger.
Yes.
And I see so much promise in them. And I will often say to my patients, I just wish you could see you how I see you, because then you wouldn't have all this guilt and shame. You would just have optimism and positivity, but that's, they have a lot of baggage they're carrying around.
As you say, those, out of the big book, you know, those drugs are, powerful and conniving. There's now I'm forgetting that phrase, but they're
and our brain never forgets.
Cunning, baffling, and powerful. Those are the three.
Yes, our brain never forgets how those drugs feel. So you know, even if you're doing well, and then something terrible happens, your brain never forgets. And I remember you were talking one time about a significant loss that you had in your life, and you said, "But not for a moment did I want to go back to using." Because that's when you know you're in recovery.
Yes.
When you override that part of your brain that says, "Oh, that's drugs will make this all go away." No.
No.
No, it won't.
You know, and that and I will say, recovery is a habit. You know, it really and so and I've said on this program, I lost a daughter in a car crash, and which didn't have anything to do with drugs or alcohol, but I had been in recovery for so many years that it really didn't occur to me to turn to drinking. And I also knew I was needed.
You know, it wasn't an option.
No, I needed, I had, you know, we had a funeral to plan. I mean, all of a sudden you have to get very busy when things like that happen. And I just knew.
You didn't have time for that. Yeah.
So I tell people, I honestly think the desire to drink, it has been lifted from me. It really, it's been lifted. And so, but it's probably due to habit, you know, and a lot of hard work.
Well, and you're so vocal about your recovery that there's an expectation. You know, if somebody's, if you went to a bar to have a drink, somebody in this community would recognize you.
I don't even want to put a stop
to that.
I don't even want to walk into a liquor store, you know, or anything like that. But it's been so good having you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me. This was fun.
We'll have to have you back. And
I would like
that. You know what? I always close the program with the serenity prayer. So if you want to pray with me, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Our guest has been Dr. Melissa Henke from Heartview. Thank you.
Thank you.
I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you don't understand. Milk blood to keep from running out. I've seen the need.